listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 21st installment in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR from the revolution in 1917 until its dissolution in 1991. Luciana, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. How are you?
Very well. I'd like to start with a paraphrase of a quote talking about Trotsky, which we're going to try to work our way into as we now focus on what happened in Russia specifically, where E.H. Carr, the British historian, journalist, etc., said essentially Trotsky was a hero during the heroic times of the revolution and no longer needed once the heroic period had ended, something to that effect.
Yes, that's why he was for a heroic permanent revolution.
That's right. I bet that's it. And he poses against that that Stalin was better suited to what was actually done, which was let's now construct, you know, do the mundane work of constructing an economy and a body politic, and that's what happened. And so we can talk about this period now. Let's from the revolution going forward.
Yeah. Sure. We left Trotsky in Spain in the last conversation.
Without cab fare, by the way.
Sorry, what?
Without cab fare, by the way. We left him in Spain with no cab fare. Go ahead, I'm sorry. I had to be snarky.
So he wasn't even in Spain. But anyway, we were discussing the influence of... We were talking about Trotsky.
Right.
Yeah,
his influence.
Trotsky's influence
yeah.
in the Spanish Civil War.
Right, exactly.
And we noticed the chaos in the economy, the factionalism, the splitting, the 3 days in Barcelona, the fight against the United Front or the resistance to the United Front and all kinds of mishmash and confusion and chaos caused by the influences of Trotsky, though I am just simplifying. But anyway, there he was. We were in Spain in between 1936 and 39, pointing out the faults, the failures in the theory. And so now we have to ask, so who is this Trotsky? And this will take us back to the early 1900s.
Right.
In order to find out who is Trotsky, we're going to have to talk about Lenin. So his followers, that is, Trotsky's followers, say that he was the true heir of Lenin and Lenin's political position, and that Stalin betrayed the revolution, that Stalin's theoretical and political views differed from those of Lenin, and so did his practices. This is Trotskyism. Essentially, why we need to talk about Trotskyism is because this is in being in this attitude that Trotsky was the true heir of Lenin and that Stalin betrayed the revolution really induces people who are inclined to be Marxist to dismiss the experiment in the Soviet Union, which was a workers' and peasant state working toward communism through paths of socialism. In other words, if we want to reconstruct a left, a revolutionary left in future, we have to understand what the Soviet Union was and not fall into the cliches and tricks of dismissing it as a distorted, deformed worker state and just toss it out of history. We can't do that. We have to understand what it was and why it fell and what forces helped him to fall and how to avoid being those forces or contributing to those forces. So, yeah,
and just let me to interrupt for a second. So, I mean, at the beginning of this, we're talking about the second Congress of what was called the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party.
Yep.
And the split happens. The split happens between two sides, one advocating that the party should be people who are, you know, immersed in revolution, not just, you know, the masses with revolutionary leadership, but revolutionaries themselves. And the other side is like, well, look, we'll be the revolutionaries and we'll go get the masses. And that is where the party split. And Lenin was on one side and Trotsky on the other.
Yeah, but I think the path to that point is also important to trace.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump the gun. I just wanted to.
No. That's exactly. It's the split is over the composition of the party,
right.
And well, it's over the statute, the constitution of the party. Number one, the number one item is that the Central Committee, the party, the leadership would be professional revolutionaries. So let's go there, okay?
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, so Trotsky was the true heir of Stalin. True heir of Lenin. And Stalin betrayed the revolution, yada, yada. So we have to look at these claims. They have to be tested. So we must go back to the beginning. When two key factions formed in 1903-1904 within the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, or Workers' Party, really. The Russian Social Democratic Labor Party was formed in 1898 in Minsk, just to unite the various revolutionary organizations of the Russian Empire into one party. Lenin joined, Stalin joined at the age of 20. Now, this is significant that it formed in 1898 because this is the boom, the beginning, and the intensification of industrialization in Russia. Therefore, we have an emerging proletariat, and we have a kind of tiny bourgeoisie. And this comes into play. So during the second Russian Social Democratic Labor Party Congress in 1903, the party split into two factions, as you mentioned, the Bolsheviks, the majority, and the Mensheviks, the minority. Now, this majority-minority applies to the way the RSDLP members voted on the statute of the party and on the organization of the party. Their vote on party agenda had been unanimous, and that was to work for democratic socialism, to accept Iskra, the political newspaper of the Russian political emigres, which was really concentrated in the group around the political newspaper of Russian socialist emigre called Iskra, the Spark. And this was established as the official organ of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And Iskra had, as I said, the six editors. Among the most prominent were the older Plekhanov and Lenin, who was in his early 30s, I think. And Martov, who became the leader of the Mensheviks. Now, the editorial line of Iskra championed the battle for political freedom as well as the cause of socialist revolution and opposed the economists. They were known as economists, and they argued against political struggle in favor of pure trade union activity for the workers' economic interest. And they also opposed the socialist revolutionaries, the Iskra group, who advocated terror tactics. Now, let me see if I have something else to say about the Iskra group. The Iskra group, you know, the Iskra newspaper was for popular distribution and was very popular until 1983, I think it is. Yeah, until 1903. But they also published a theoretical journal, Zaria, and this was really the initiative of Lenin in London. This was happening in London. So, but the Bolsheviks, so, you know, in 1923, Lenin said that Bolshevism as a stream of political thought and as a political party had existed since 1903. And what he meant was that in 1902, he had published his first major work, What is to be Done? And there he stressed the importance of theory and revolutionary party guided by that theory. So in Lenin, I think this is the addition to Marx, I really think, at least the emphasis. Lenin stresses the importance of theory and a revolutionary party guided by that theory.
Right.
He says, without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement.
Right.
The role of vanguard fighter can be fulfilled only by a party that is guided by the most advanced theory. So what he wanted in the Bolshevik party that ticked off the Mensheviks, who became the Mensheviks, was a quality, not quantity. He wanted trained professional revolutionaries who could do the guiding. Of course, this was then extremely opposed by Trotsky as, you know, centralization, autarky, etc. It, and you know. Lenin, in What Is to Be Done, goes on to quote Engels that the theoretical struggle is just as important as political and economic struggle. So this, of course, goes criticizes the economists who argued who were for trade union activity and waiting around until sort of, you know, capitalism will soften and whatever, but it's really social democracy and trade unionism.
Yeah, I mean,
and
they,
by the way, Trotsky started as a trade unionist. Go ahead.
Yeah, so what I'm saying basically is what it does is it concedes almost the moral authority, but in any event, the existence and the continuing existence of the existing political economy, you know, of a capitalist mm-hmm. economy, and says, however, you know, we can go to the table organized as best we can as workers, and we have power inside those relations, and we should exercise them, you know, that power, and we will maximize our position that way. It's both evolutionary in terms of how it looks out, as opposed to revolutionary, but also what it does is it cedes the legitimacy of the existing political economy as a given. And that's really a central ideological point of divergence from Lenin and the Bolsheviks.
Yeah. I mean, Lenin goes on to quote Engels that the theoretical struggle is just as important as political and economic struggle. The working class will not, and this I think is so important to realize for us, the working class will not spontaneously become political simply by fighting economic battles with employers over wages, working hours, and the like. In other words, the trade union politics is not going to lead you to revolution. And we know today that wages, working hours, and all kinds of improvement that happened under the Roosevelt administration for 30 years of the New Deal are all taken back.
Right.
That's the importance of a revolutionary outlook. And and that was what Marx meant by permanent revolution. I'm not going to talk about that because I'll go crazy today if I go into permanent revolution. But what Marx meant in 1850 when he said, okay, fine, the proletarian is weak, we have to ally ourselves with the petty bourgeoisie, but do not forget that the workers have to have their own party, their own organization. They have to keep the idea of revolution alive among them. And he ended the speech with permanent revolution, you know. But but it means that the working class can be bought off by the bourgeoisie.
Which is what we saw happen. You know, you had a couple of phenomena that, and I don't want to get too far off the track yet either, but that we saw develop. Number one, with the U.S., for example, and Western Europe intensifying imperialism over time, there was extra money when they went out looting the planet, and they brought money back to the castle, and they were divvying it up. Well, there were a few shekels that they could throw to the workers to keep them calm domestically and have them go into the army and defend it and all of that. And, of course, after a while, when that money dries up, they turn around and eat them. And then when you had the Soviet Union existing, and also China before the split, as an alternative to the world, you had pressure on the system here again to satisfy some of the demands of workers. And so the working class here following that line accommodated it. They said, okay, great. Here's an advantage for us. Now we can pressure for higher wages. We can get all the benefits that they did get, the welfare state in much of Europe and all of that. And then, you know, once these guys turn around and decide the time's up, they just turn around and start taking it away. And because there's no independent base and there's no critique of the system that allows workers to say, oh, okay, fine, well, this is over. You guys are out. Bye. It's our state.
In addition, we're off now. In addition, those workers who got the benefit back from the colonies, well, they didn't. So what happened in Western left in the 1960s, for instance, in France with Algeria, didn't give a damn about Algeria, aroused by Sartre and those people, about the colonial situation, about the colonized. This is a critique that Mao makes. This is a critique that Lenin made in the beginning, you know, the support of colonial people. So the Western left became an aristocracy of labor, thought of itself as, oh, gee, we're getting all these benefits. We don't need to look at the colonial world. But where today are the jobs gone?
That's right. You know, Malcolm X and Lumumba and a whole lot of people brought this question up also back in the late 50s, early 60s. And Malcolm wasn't even a socialist at that point. And yet it was evident to people that were familiar with the struggle of people of color, third world peoples, etc., that this wealth that you guys think you're generating, you just stole it from my living room, you know?
Yeah. To return to Marx was saying, to get back to what Lenin was saying. He said to convert the working class to Marxism, Lenin insists that Marxists should form a political party, a vanguard, a dedicated revolution of dedicated revolutionaries to spread Marxist political ideas among the workers. This is, I think, an important observation. Are workers born with the gene for revolution?
Of course not.
Do they have an instinct for revolution? Would anybody, if they have what they need?
Of course not.
No.
I mean, this is an essentially Marxist, you know, a foundational Marxist thought anyway. You know, workers, your consciousness is a product of your material condition. I guess that's the philosophical statement of the approach to it. In which
that's
case,
right.
Workers don't have a gene for revolution. They have a condition that breeds revolution, or they don't.
That's right. So if they're made aware that those benefits that they get are conditional upon the whims of the market, of the interest of the capitalists, they have to know that these are always in danger. That's where the permanent revolution business comes in.
That's right.
It's a tactic to preserve, to go on, because the alliance with the bourgeoisie, the benefits that you get within capitalism are provisional.
Right.
They can always be taken away.
Right.
So what you have, and I think there is a quote somewhere by Lenin, just a second, I'll get to it. Yeah, you have benefits under bourgeois government, and that's not permanent.
Right.
So this pamphlet, What is to Be Done, was really the prelude to the split of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party between Lenin's Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. Now, just to see where Bolshevism, the character of Bolshevism as wanting a vanguard party and masses of people acting but guided by the party, this character emerged from the struggle of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party against, I think, three forces within the original party. One was the Narodniks, that were the Narodniks, the group that they were revolutionary populists, and they placed the driving force behind the coming revolution or the desired revolution among the peasantry, whereas Plekhanov, who was older than Lenin but was working with Lenin and Iskra, broke from the Narodniks and said, no, the driving force of the revolution is the proletariat. And this is also significant. The party was founded in the 1890s, just as industrialization, at least in Petersburg and certain big centers and in the Caucasus, was taking off. So the Narodniks had placed the hope for the revolution in the peasantry, and now the proletarian was being elevated to the driving force at this point by the theorists what became the Bolshevist branch. So the Bolshevik character emerged from the struggle with the Narodniks and then with the struggle with the legal Marxist. And it also emerged from the struggle with the economists, which we just outlined. And with the legal Marxists were really basically your liberals. What happened in Russia in the 1890s is that the Russian bourgeoisie was opposed to feudal autocracy and absolutism, and so was friendly toward Marxist ideas. But of course, like all the bourgeoisies in everywhere else, they really weren't that interested in revolution and were liberal. I mean, this is what Lenin called them. The economists we have talked about, and apropos of them, Lenin said, "A trade union policy for the working class is simply a bourgeois policy for the working class," which sums up everything that we've been mentioning.
Right.
He said that political and economic agitation, both, not just economic, you know, for wages, trade unionism, political, this is where he's going towards. We must seize power eventually, you know, in the April thesis. So he says both political and economic agitation were needed to raise class consciousness of the masses. In other words, the masses learned as they got involved, as they agitated, but they agitated for things larger than just reform or you know, the wages, the benefits. And Lenin said the two could not be separated, since every class struggle is essentially political. So the legal Marxists, who were in essence a bourgeois group advocating bourgeois policies through a Marxist idiom. Now, you see, we have the economists, the trade unionists. They are an authentic working class movement, the economists. But they are trade unionist and they're easily pacified. The other branch, the legal Marxists, they're called legal Marxists because they want to get to socialism through parliamentary devices.
Right.
And they essentially insist on the stages of revolution that Marx outlined in the Communist Manifesto, which Lenin altered, I think. So,
With the benefit of Lenin had the benefit of another, you know, 60 or 70 years of history that unfolded. So, you know, you think
exactly, course and he had correction. The benefit of the Paris Commune,
right? And you know
there was a bit of history, and he had Marx.
You know, Marx's own system. And I mean, look, when we're talking about scientific socialism, when we're talking about a scientific approach to history and human development, science. Mm-hmm. Looks constantly for new data to challenge its assumptions and to help further formulate them, to process them. And so, you know, of course, I mean, there are people that think that what fell out of Marx's fingers in 1848, that's, you know, as sacrosanct as God's word and not to be challenged. And Marx himself would criticize that highly.
Yes, yes. And I mean, this is the sort of an idealistic, like a god, a divine worship of Marx, the infallible prophet, and it's entirely bourgeois.
Yes, it is. And actually,
to regard him as a Bible, to regard his 1850, he was saying permanent revolution, and then that becomes this phrase that Trotsky spends years elaborating.
Yep, and look, this is something that resembles the history of Christianity, both in the Roman tradition and also in the Orthodox tradition. We got to stop there. At least we now have an agenda. We made our way through item one. Luciana, I'm looking forward to speaking with you again next week. And we'll work on number two. Next week will be Trotsky and Lenin in the years after 1905, the Prague Conference, Vienna Conference, etc. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Don. Always a pleasure.
Yes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to World Apart. The Israeli leadership wasted no time in painting Donald Trump's move on Jerusalem as a historic landmark, falling, of course, within its own interpretation of history. The lavishing of praise intensified even more after the United States had to invoke a veto against its own allies at the Security Council. What does Israel hope to gain from this isolating show of support? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Dan Dyker, fellow at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Mr. Dyker, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, let me know if you disagree, and I bet you disagree with that, but I think the Israeli authorities, and first and foremost, Prime Minister Netanyahu, are very apparent in their efforts to oversell what Donald Trump really said on the status of Jerusalem. Netanyahu called that decision courageous and just at a time when the State Department actually tried very hard to persuade everybody that there was absolutely nothing extraordinary in it. Why is Israel trying to package this announcement for what it's not?
Well, Israel is trying to basically affirm what the American people have said for 22 years. And it's unfortunate that so many people around the world, Russia, by the way, not included, have gone against the will of the American people. As a matter of fact, Russia recognized Jerusalem already for a long time, certainly the western side of the city. And the American people have said Jerusalem is Israel's capital. The Israeli people have known that. Everybody in this part of the world knows. Everyone knows that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. Not everyone publicly agrees with it, but everybody knows another fact. That if you want to have stability in the Middle East, you want to have security in the Middle East, recognize Jerusalem and let the Israeli security forces keep Jerusalem safe for people of all religions.
But Mr. Dyker, I think there is a lot of space for innuendos here because the State Department had to issue several clarifications stating that Washington indeed wasn't trying to influence the talks on the status and the separation of Jerusalem in any way. But I think the Israeli authorities very deliberately make it appear as if Donald Trump was speaking about Jerusalem as a whole.
Well, Oksana, look, it's very important to understand that the State Department was saying something true in this particular case. Donald Trump, President Trump, said that the status quo, remember that word, status quo, that's a code word for keeping things as they are. What the United States did was to correct an injustice and a position that had been incorrect and biased against Israel, very much, unfortunately, at the behest of Israel's friends in Europe, which held they prejudged the outcome of negotiations by trying to recognize or suggest that the Palestinians should have a capital on the eastern side of the city. That's a prejudgment of negotiations. The State Department is saying no. The negotiations have to come directly between the sides. All the United States did was to fulfill the will of the American people and presidents before Donald Trump that for political reasons decided at the last minute to mobilize that six-month waiver. State Department said no, negotiations is what will determine the ultimate status of Israel's of the Holy City.
Well, Mr. Dyker, as you can imagine, we in Russia don't treat the word of the American president or even the American Congress as the word of God. So it's just the position of one country, which, by the way, is strongly opposed by pretty much everybody else in the international community, except Israel. At the same time, there is a whole body of international agreements specifically stating and providing for this two-state solution based on the 1967 borders before Israel occupied East Jerusalem. Did you read Trump's statements as diverging from that in any way?
Oksana, your facts are wrong, unfortunately. I mean, they're dead wrong. In the Oslo agreements, it says specifically that the final core issues, including including settlements, including the future of Jerusalem, and final borders will be determined by negotiations. UN Security Council Resolution 242 has governed Israeli-Palestinian diplomacy for decades, since 1967, and it makes absolutely no mention whatsoever of Israel's requirement to return to the indefensible 1967
line. Mr. Dyker, nowhere in the international agreements it is stated that Israel can have Jerusalem only to itself. Can you mention any specific document that would proclaim internationally that Jerusalem is the sole capital of Israel and nothing else?
Listen, countries work according to their national interests. Everybody who has eyeballs in their head knows that the Jewish people have had Jerusalem three times in their history over the last 3,700 years. Since 1949, Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel. Every Israeli knows that. Every man, woman, and child knows that. Every country that comes to visit Israel, they come to Jerusalem, where our seat of government is located, where all our government offices are located, where most of our government offices are located, where our Knesset, our parliament is located. So it's very clear to everyone inside the country, and I think around the world, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. And that's the fact.
Well, it's very clear to everybody around the world, including Russia, that Israel certainly has a historic connection to Jerusalem. Nobody is disputing that. What the rest of the international community is saying is that the Palestinian historic connection to Jerusalem is just as strong. Is Israel going, and you personally, are you going to accept that?
What Palestinian historic connection to Jerusalem are you talking about? The Palestinians, in fact, the Jordanians would curse you for that statement. In fact, the Jordanians, the Hashemite kingdom, has been the 43rd direct descendant of the prophet, according to the tradition of Islam, would ascribe the custodianship to the Hashemite kingdom and King Abdullah II. And in fact, that is a strategic mandate for Jordan, that is basically embedded and sanctified in internationally approved agreements.
Mr. Dyker, I'm well familiar with your position on Jordan, but thankfully Jordan is not the only member of the international community here. But rather than arguing about that, let me ask you something else. Unlike a number of his predecessors, including Barack Obama when he was presidential candidate, President Trump said nothing in this latest statement about the undivided nature of Jerusalem. If Trump is indeed so courageous, as you seem to believe, why do you think he didn't go that far?
Because he basically laid out a principle, Oksana, which is that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, recognized by the United States of America at the will of the American people. He didn't want to prejudice negotiations. You know, all of you guys in the international media, a lot of you guys have not done your homework and are basically trying to ascribe to President Trump things that he didn't say or he didn't mean. He basically recognized a long overdue correction. And the correction is a principle. And the principle is the United States recognizes what every Israeli government has recognized, what every Israeli man, woman, and child has recognized. Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. What goes on after that in terms of negotiation, well, that's why the president said status quo.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson also said that the United States is not planning to move embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem until 2020, and that the American government maps, on the American government maps, Jerusalem will still be not identified as Israeli territory. What's the point of calling a spade without drawing it as such?
Well, the truth, that's the very point, that it's a matter of principle, but in terms of changing the technical aspects or to operationalize the principle and change all the technical aspects that come after that, that's something you'd have to ask the State Department employees that handle the technical shifting of maps in the State Department. It's a question of stages. It's a question of process. And you probably know very well, diplomacy doesn't happen overnight, and the implementation of policy doesn't happen overnight. And everybody, you know, the Jewish people have waited over 2,000 years for this decision, and they can wait a few more years for the implementation of the American decision at the State Department level.
you know very well that this announcement didn't sit well with a lot of people in the Palestinian Authority, most notably Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, stating that he would no longer accept the United States as a Mideast mediator. And, you know, I find your opinions on the Palestinians sometimes pretty harsh, but having said that, do you think this kind of alienation is really in Israel's interest? Because if there would be somebody else, some other power trying to mediate this process, do you think that power would have represented Israel's interest just as faithfully as the United States has always done?
Well, I can tell you, Oksana, this. The Palestinian leadership, as headed by Chairman Mahmoud Abbas, is making a fatal mistake by trying to BDS, by trying to boycott and sanction the United States, who gives them more money than the combination of all the European states put together. And that really goes for the Arab states as well. The United States has been the biggest purveyor and the biggest cheerleader for Palestinian independence. And together with Israel, by the way, have done more to advance Palestinian independence than any other country in the world. So the problem is that the Palestinian Authority is working against the will of its own people. And I can tell you, as somebody that's in the West Bank every day talking to the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Authority have become a cynical, terror-supporting entity that is not working towards peace and that have no interest in, at this point, coming to the negotiating table and negotiating with Israel. And this is against the will of its own people. And if you were here in the areas of Jerusalem and gone through the West Bank and have real conversations with Palestinian professionals, you'd realize that they're all saying Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas are working against the interests of their own people. And that's why he could never get elected again if he went to elections opposite Hamas.
Well, Mr. Dyker, as you know, there are a number of countries in the region with the ambition of playing a role in the Middle East peace process. And one of them is Turkey, which already announced its hope to move its Palestinian embassy to East Jerusalem. Now, President Erdogan is a far more ambitious and, I think, cunning figure than Trump. And I suspect he may be in power for a bit longer than Trump. Is having Trump siding more explicitly with the Israelis worth others like Mr. Erdogan rallying so eagerly around the Palestinians?
Well, I think cunning is a very good word, Oksana, for President Erdogan. He's become the leader of the new neo-Ottoman Islamic radical movement in the Middle East, and he's always been interested in lighting a fire underneath the stability of Jerusalem. It's been very clear that President Erdogan has been involved in supporting the Northern Islamic movement, in advancing the propaganda that Al-Aqsa Mosque is in danger, and he has been very much a participant and a supporter of all of the instability that's gone on by radical Islamic groups on the Temple Mount. The Jordanians are not happy with him. The Egyptians are not happy with him. The Saudis are not happy with him. And that's why the Egyptian and the Saudi leaders didn't show up at the OIC meeting last week in Istanbul. So he is not exactly the best friend or even close to being a good friend of the Sunni Arab establishment.
Mr. Dyker, there are no friends in the international community, let alone in your own region. But we are talking about responsible politics and geopolitics. What I ask you about, not the sort of, you know, to paint me the picture of Mr. Erdogan. Believe me, I know his picture better than you do. After all, Russia had its own very, very difficult period with Turkey after Turkey shut down our own plane over Syria. That's not what I ask you about. I ask you about whether it was responsible to take this kind of decision that does not bring any immediate benefits, neither to Israel nor to the United States, that the United States does not even plan to follow up within the next coming years. And by the nature of making that decision, give all that fire, give all that rhetoric, give all that fodder to international figures like Mr. Erdogan, do you think that was responsible?
I think it's very responsible for the following reason. If you want to have stability, security in the Middle East, you had better be on the team that is being led by the Israelis. I think that, you know, the Saudis, the Egyptians, and the Jordanians all understand that the future of their security and the future of a stable Middle East is located in the small state of Israel, nation state of the Jewish people. No, the entire Arab world understands that if this region is going to survive Iranian regime subterfuge and subversion of the entire region, it's Israel that they can depend on. That's why there's been such a sea change in the geopolitics of this region. And they know that President Erdogan has played an unhelpful role with, and I think the Russians know it as well as anybody else. The United States knows it. The moderate Arab countries know it. Israel knows it. So while Israel wants to have good relationships with good relations with Turkey, as we've had for decades.
Well, Mr. Diker, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dan Diker, fellow at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Mr. Diker, it's clear that Israel may want to have good relations with many countries, but the country that you most fundamentally have been focused on is Saudi Arabia. Everybody knows about the rapprochement, but in order for that to continue, you will have to have not only the goodwill of the kings, whether it is in Saudi Arabia or in Jordan for that matter, but also the goodwill of people in the Arab street. Do you think the perception of Israel on the Arab street has improved as a result of the announcement made by Mr. Trump?
Well, that's actually a good question. We'd have to do some polling to understand that. The problem with the Arab street has been that they have a very problematic relationship with a lot of their leaders, and they look for any opportunity to come out and to under the fake banner of Israel as some sort of a mini imperialist nation, they'll hit the streets when their misplaced anger is really against their own leadership. I mean, that's the ABCs of Arab public politics.
If that's the case, why is the only democracy in the Middle East is so eager to cooperate with Saudi Arabia, admittedly the most repressive regime in the region?
No, you should ask a different question. How come Israel and Russia have such a good relationship?
Well, I don't think you would claim that Russia is a repressive dictatorship. You may have criticism about Russia's political system, but I hope you wouldn't argue that it is just as bad as in Saudi Arabia.
No, I'm not arguing that. In fact, I'm very, you know, when you look at the side of the very close cooperation between Israel and President Putin, especially when it comes to turning back radical Islamic operatives, where you have tens of millions of those in Moscow alone, you know, one can only look with satisfaction at the Russian-Israeli relationship, especially in the cooperation to the north of Israel, where Russia is playing a role, a very substantial role, in Syria. And Israel's cooperating with Russia. There's some that would say that Russia has become the major superpower occupier of Syria today.
Mr. Diker, you know better than I do that Russia is present in Syria at the invitation of the UN-recognized sovereign government. And the occupation of the territories, Palestinian territories by Israel is not recognized by the international community. So there is an important distinction here. But let me again bring you back to the issue of establishing or at least fostering peace in the region, because the recognition of the state of Israel 70 years ago was based on the explicit condition that a Jewish state would live side by side with the Palestinian state. If that condition is not fulfilled, aren't you concerned that the concept of a dedicated Jewish state will lose its appeal within the international community?
Well, first of all, Oksana, I have to correct you. Your facts are wrong. The partition plan of November 29th, 1947, called for the establishment of a Jewish state and an Arab state, not a Palestinian
beside
state.
Beside an Arab state. And what was meant is not the state of Saudi Arabia or not the state of Jordan, but a state of Palestine. Can we agree on that at least?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't called the state of Palestine. Otherwise, the UN Special Committee on Palestine would have called it the state of Palestine. The Palestinians themselves considered themselves part of southern Syria, which you probably know as being an expert in the region. The problem was that Israel was attacked by six of its neighbors. And look how far geopolitics has changed in the last 70 years, where you have a total realignment in the Middle East, and all of the violence that's taken place in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, What does that have to do with Jerusalem? It has absolutely nothing to do with Jerusalem. The Arab world is imploding because, in large part, the development of ISIS on the one hand and the development of the Iranian regime's race for nuclear and terror supremacy throughout the Middle East.
Well, Mr. Diker, as you said, I've been following this issue long enough to see the gradual decline in support for the two-state solution. I think Israel may soon find itself the only party speaking in favor of this increasingly theoretical proposal. More and more people in Europe and Russia, in Asia, in Latin America believe that if the two-state solution is not possible, then Israel will have to do what democracies are required to do, and that is to provide fair and equal treatment to all, including those living in the occupied territories. Are you prepared to be a democracy, not just a Jewish democracy, but a democracy full stop?
No, no, you got it wrong. We are prepared to be a Jewish democracy, and that's what we are. You have to visit Israel. You're very welcome to come. I'll host you. Through the Jerusalem Center, and we'll show you what a real thriving liberal democracy is in the Jewish form of democracy. And it's not only about matzo ball soup or about hummus. It's about real freedom. And if you ask the 1,200,000 Israeli Arabs that live in complete freedom, freer than in any Arab country in the Middle East, you'll understand why.
Yeah, that freedom comes at the cost to your neighbors, though. If we also look at the way the Israeli military treats the Palestinian civilians, let me tell you, this is not a pretty picture. And I come from a country that has a long tradition of state violence, but even for us, this is a lot when you see the Israeli soldiers kicking children, when you see them hitting women. That's not a pretty picture of Jewish democracy.
Oksana, you're drinking the Kool-Aid. You're drinking the Kool-Aid. I know exactly what you're referring to. You're referring to the propaganda pictures that come out of the Palestinian Ma'an news agency. Listen, I have children in the, you know, in the Israeli army, and our army is the most moral army in the world, bar none, and it's recognized in the West as being one of the an army that is limited, constrained by international law through self-constraint more than any other army in the world. And in, just that you should know, Israel has public diplomacy and legal officers attached to battalions and other major parts of the army, so that it is in complete compliance with international law. And we have to be extra careful because we live in a situation where the Hamas and the PLO and the Fatah are trying to pull us in to urban warfare and urban terrorism situations. So we have to be particularly careful. And I think we have only what to be proud of when it comes to relationships with the Palestinian public. And there's no surprise, Oksana, as to why thousands upon thousands of Palestinians are looking to become Israeli citizens every year. Why is that happening?
Mr. Diker, I think Israel is a beautiful country, and your people can be really proud of what you have achieved. I'm just saying that you're not treating your neighbors fairly, and I think this sense of injustice towards the Palestinians is actually growing, not only within the Middle East, but also within the larger international community. You know that many Europeans, many people in Asia, in Latin America, believe that Israel is not treating Palestinians as it promised and as it should. Speaking of which, you know that the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called for the General Assembly this week. Do you think, which side do you think will be supported more eagerly at that very representative assembly?
I'll answer that question in a moment, but I want to be very sure you're not misleading your viewers. You know, 98.5% of all Palestinians live under Palestinian jurisdiction, military jurisdiction in Area A and civil and administrative jurisdiction in Area B. So that's 98.5%.
You invited me to Israel. I, on behalf of the Palestinians, invite you to visit Gaza or the West Bank, and then we can talk. But I think we will never agree on that issue. So let's go to the specific question that I ask you. Do you think the international community this week is more likely to support, to side with Israel or with the Palestine?
Oksana, first of all, there is no Palestine. There's something called a Palestinian Authority.
The Palestinian Authority. Okay, I didn't do my homework again.
Exactly, but that's okay because you corrected yourself. Here's the point, Oksana. The point is, if the international community wants terrorism, violence, and death, they can support a resolution that will make the PLO and the Hamas the custodians of your Russian security in the Russian compound in Jerusalem. If you want to have stability, security, and protection of the holy city for Christians, for Jews, and for Muslims, the international community had better side with Israel and the United States, because that is what Israel and the United States, and I believe many of its other allies, really stand for, is security, democracy, freedom, and protection of the holy sites for everyone. Now, if I were you, or if I were in the international community, I certainly wouldn't put my marbles with the PLO and Hamas defending my national interests, particularly all of the millions and millions of dollars of Russian real estate interest in Jerusalem.
Well, we are not comparing the two systems here. I think this is a deflection from, to be honest with you, this is a deflection from what I really ask you. But since we have only a few minutes left, even before the Trump's announcement, the Palestinians were trying to advance their cause with the help of international institutions. And Israel always felt negative about this. Now that you have enlisted the help of the American administration so eagerly, do you have any arguments left against the Palestinians' efforts to internationalize this issue?
You know, the Palestinians have used the United Nations as a weapon of war against the future of peace, both for Palestinians and Israelis. The Palestinian Authority actually mobilized the UNESCO to cancel out any connection between the Jewish people and its own historic capital in Jerusalem. Now, if that isn't pure hypocrisy, and if that doesn't cancel out any moral and ethical fiber of the United Nations,
so
I don't know what will.
So you don't trust UNESCO. Okay, do you trust the UN General Assembly? Do you trust UN General Assembly as a neutral representation of the international community voices on that?
Well, the United Nations General Assembly has passed more resolutions against the Democratic State of Israel than it has against North Korea and Iran and Syria combined. So, you know, it is a bubbling cauldron of hatred and anti-democracy. And the Security Council it made a shameful decision in approving UN Security Council Resolution 2334 back in December of 16, which represented a new low point, a nadir for the moral clarity, or I should say cloudiness, of the Security Council. The United States, unfortunately, in an unprecedented move, refused to, under the Obama administration, it refused to veto that horrendously biased, and I would even say anti-Semitic, resolution against Israel. The Trump administration is correcting that injustice.
Well, Mr. Diker, isn't it surprising that every time when you come to a critical discussion on Israel, there is always an accusation of anti-Semitism surfacing? But anyway, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate you being on the show and being so forceful in defending your point of view. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.